Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.
Hello, producer Daisha Johnson here. We want to thank you all so much for the support that we've gotten for this project. If this is your first episode of Uncertain Terms, I recommend scrolling back and starting with our introduction episode, followed by our first true episode, which is the Dennis Kramer 1968 Brevard County murder. Melissa and I recently did an Ask Us Anything on TC Palm's Facebook page, and I wanted to share that audio with you. We answered a lot of questions about what it was like sitting in court during these resentencing hearings. We talked about having to look at autopsy photos and the crime scene evidence. And we also talked about some of our favorite episodes, as well as the really hard parts of producing this project. Melissa and I did share a mic for this event, so the audio might not sound like it did in some of the other episodes, but I do think it's still worth a listen. If you have any questions, you can always reach us on Twitter. We're at Uncertain Terms. Or you can email us at uncertainterms@tcpalm.com. And really quick, if you do like what we're doing, please give us a review on Apple Podcasts or wherever you listen to your podcasts, or just suggest this podcast to a friend. We would like to get it out to as many people as possible. All right, here is that Ask Us Anything. There we go. I think we are officially live now.
Sure looks that way.
Hi, everybody. Welcome to TC Palm's audio studio or podcast studio. I am producer Daisha Johnson.
And I am Melissa Holzman, legal affairs reporter.
And we are the creators and hosts of Uncertain Terms, which is our new true crime podcast that we launched in January. And so we wanted to host an Ask Us Anything type of Q&A where you guys can ask us all of your questions and we can answer some of the things that you want to know about. So, Melissa, you want to tell them a little bit about the podcast?
Sure. Well, first of all, we're in the recording studio that we use quite a bit to record all of our episodes, and it's about the size as what you're seeing right here, except maybe a couple of microphones off to the side. Uncertain Terms is a 5-episode podcast that took us about a year to put together, and it's based on cases of juveniles who had committed murder, who were sentenced to life in prison, and because of changes in juvenile sentencing laws over a period of time, they were allowed to come back to court and plead their case to a judge to see if they should serve less than life or possibly even go free.
I'm on a laptop here, so I can see you guys' comments coming in. So we can get started. We've had about a dozen questions come in already. So just to start off, let's talk about how we got the audio for all of these episodes that we did.
Yeah, one of the things you might notice, and if you've listened to all of the episodes, the quality of the audio is different from time to time. Some of it sounds louder, some of it sounds softer. Listening to us talk is a little different. We have fancy microphones that we can talk into here. But to get this archive audio, some of it came from VHS tapes. Some of it came from, in fact, the weirdest way we had to get in a 1979 case, the audio from the court proceedings was on reel-to-reel. So we had to work with the state's attorney's office. They found companies to go digitize this for us. And there were times that we literally would sit in front of a television with the VHS tape running of a trial from maybe 20, 30 years ago, recording it with a little digital recorder. So there was really a whole bunch of different ways. We would ask the court officials to go into their boxes of evidence. They found cassette tapes, sometimes those teeny little mini cassette tapes. And at one time, they broke a tape trying to make a copy for us. They weren't too thrilled about that. So we had to really cast a wide net and trying to figure out what audio was available and how we could bring these stories to life, if you will, that were sometimes 25, 30 years old even.
And a little bit too, just having to sit in the hearings and, you know, sometimes we had to just sit in the back of a courtroom and record
Other times we were able to put our recorder a little bit closer to where people were talking. So, I mean, every experience in every single episode and every single day was different when trying to collect this audio.
Oh, yeah. And it was a bit of a challenge. Sometimes we used our phones. iPhones have really cool voice recording apps that you can use now. We used a tiny little digital recorder. Sometimes if we weren't at the trial itself or the hearing, we had to rely on the court reporting services. Sometimes the audio wasn't so great. If someone happened to lean back instead of leaning forward, all of a sudden you could see them on the video, but you couldn't hear them. So we tried the best we could. So that kind of explains why the audio is sometimes all over the map on these.
A little caveat too, this was my very first experience producing a podcast.
And you did such a fabulous job.
Thank you. And working with audio in the first place. So things were not perfect in each episode, and I can absolutely admit to that, you know, moving forward and maybe the next season, there are some things that I would do a little bit differently, but it was a great learning experience to just even put something together in the first place.
But, you know, to me, though, working with this archive audio, I knew that it was such an effective way to bring these voices forward and to help tell the story, and I knew that some of the quality would be better than others, so honestly, that part didn't really bother me that much. I felt more of a responsibility. Say, if we were sitting with someone right in front of us and we were interviewing them, or we were here in the studio, then I think we had a heightened responsibility to really deliver stellar audio. And sometimes you just have to work with what you got.
Another question that we had come in is, do we record on our iPhones or fancy journalist recorders? Somebody said. If you are asking about us being in our studio, we have equipment. We were able to build a studio and bring in some really high-quality microphones.
In this closet.
If you can hear the buzzing noise, yes, there's a buzzing noise in this studio. I have to edit that out of every single one of our episodes. I can't do that right now because we're live. Sorry. But if we are sitting in court, I have used my iPhone as a backup. We use just handheld recorders too. So,
and you used your laptop a couple of times, remember? I mean, when we were still trying to figure out what we were doing and what gave us the best quality, we would sometimes use two or three different sources and then listen to it later and see which gave us the best quality.
Right.
So there's a learning curve.
This is a question that we've gotten from several people. What was it like sitting in court near these killers?
Oh, man, that's a loaded question. You go first.
Let me just make sure we're here. You guys can you guys still hear us and see us? It says we have low connectivity. We're going to keep going. We will post this full version after we're done being live. And if you have questions and we're not live anymore, please ask them. I'll be checking in on this through the next few days and can answer those. But to jump into that question, what was it like sitting in court? You know, first of all, each courtroom was a little bit different. Some of them were really small and it was a more intimate setting. Others were bigger and so we weren't sitting quite as close to these killers. For me personally, I have to come at this as in a very neutral place. And so that's what I'm there for. I'm a journalist. I'm there to do a specific job. So I truly try not to pay attention to the way that I was feeling. Of course, it's hard in some cases if I'm sitting directly behind a killer who is hearing directly from a family member of somebody that he killed. That was really hard. There was so much emotion happening in front of me. And of course, it was emotional and it was kind of a weird sense to have this person who committed murder just sitting right in front of me. So I hope that explains it.
Yeah, and it was a real challenge, too, where you have to be doing so many things at the same time. Because as a killer, for instance, if they're making what's called their allocution, where, for instance, they didn't subject themselves to cross-examination during their hearing, but they still have a legal right to make a statement to the judge, which means that they're not open to cross-examination. They can make an apology to the family, or they can say whatever they want to the judge as far as what the appropriate sentence is or what's going on with their life. So you want to watch what they're saying. You want to see how the judge is looking at them. But then you want to make sure that you're observing the reaction from the people in the courtroom, whether it was the killer's family or the family members of the victim that was killed. So there's a lot going on all at the same time, trying to soak all of this in, because sometimes I felt like the words that they were saying and the impact it had on people around them in the courtroom was almost as important to observe as what was coming out of their mouth and trying to see what kind of impact it was having on them. And, you know, there were a couple times where, you know, you could kind of predict what the killers were going to say in one respect, because this is their chance to tell the judge that their life has changed. They're not the same person as they were as a teenager. So in some respects, I wasn't really surprised by some of the things that they said, but I think there was always a part of me in the background that thought, do they really mean this? Are they really being sincere? Mm-hmm. Is this really where their heart is? Because we'll never know, truthfully. Yeah, and I think some of that came through with some of these offenders more than others.
And that leads us into another question, and that is, did these killers seem remorseful?
I would say overall, yes. I think that the ones that we featured in the four different cases that we profiled, I do, because for one thing, we took the approach where all of the cases that we did were, some of them were decades old. And so we were dealing with people who had been incarcerated anywhere from 50 to 25 years. Clearly, they're not the same people they were when they entered prison. They weren't the same impetuous, irresponsible teenagers that committed these crimes. Mm-hmm. And I do think that they have had a lot of time to think about the seriousness of the lives that they impacted, how they ruined their own lives, and the lives of the victims that they killed. But again, you know, we saw a snapshot of who these people are at that, you know, short little window of time when they're really trying to put their best foot forward. In fact, one of the prosecutors that we spoke to quite often, our chief prosecutor, chief assistant attorney, Tom Backdahl, he put it to me one time. He was like, as the prosecution is going on and they're young and they're, you know, the judge is determining their sentence, they want to fake bad. They want to make it look like there's a reason, you know, they were either crazy or there's stuff going on in their life. They want to look worse than they really are, you know, to try and mitigate or explain why they did. But when it's decades later and now they have a chance to get a reduced term, they want to fake good. You know, they want to really put their best foot forward. They want to present themselves in the best light. So sometimes you're not really going to know where they're coming from.
Yeah. Excuse me. I think when I was paying attention to the body language, each killer seemed a little bit different. I think who stood out the most to me was James Morgan. He just seemed like a very sad person after, you know, what has happened to him throughout his life. So, you know, do we really know, as Melissa said, are they remorseful? Are they not? Are they telling us how they really feel? I don't know, but I think that the body language between somebody like James Morgan versus Brooks Belay, who seemed to stand up really tall and strong with his big broad shoulders, just the two of them, I thought were drastically different when they were speaking in court.
And Lanadia Ash, when she addressed the judge, she spoke for about 7 or 8 minutes straight. And it was all from a letter that she had written. So it was clear. Well, they all had a letter, but, you know, a couple of them only talked for a couple of minutes. I felt like she had thought very long and hard and very deeply about what she wanted to say. And she really talked a lot about how her life has changed and who she was and the effect that the trauma that she suffered as a child and the personal growth that she had to go through and the pain that that caused her. And I've, you know, she choked up a couple of times. You know, I mean, this was not easy for the killers to stand up in court and do this.
Hi, Eve. Thanks. You're saying connectivity's a little spotty. Yeah, we're seeing that in our studio as well. We're so sorry. Stick around. If this video is spotty, I'm going to edit it down and just post the whole version right after we're done, so you can stay tuned for that part. And again, submit comments even if the video is done. For those of you just joining us, we are the creators and hosts of Uncertain Terms, which is our true crime podcast. We're just doing a Q&A now that our full season is out. We're asking your questions, so drop us some questions. We'll do our best to answer them. And so we are
going
to keep going.
This is Daisha Johnson, and I'm Melissa Holzman.
Daisha Johnson, I'm the producer, Melissa Holzman. Mm-hmm. She wrote everything. She's the reporter and the brains behind everything. I just made it sound pretty.
Oh, no, you did a lot more than that. But I couldn't have done this without Daisha. There's no two ways about that. And I'll tell you straight up, when we first started writing the first episode, the idea was that I would be the main narrator, and Daisha would just magically mix all of the music and the voices and everything. And I was writing and talking, and I thought, oh my gosh, I'm sick of listening to my own voice already. I know that the audience could just, you know, because it's such a subjective thing. So Daisha and I tried it. We talked into a microphone. We had a kind of a recording session. and we just hit it. I feel like we have a really good rapport. Daisha is so bright and so quick study and trying to absorb all of the legal background of this stuff. You know, I have the advantage of, I've been a legal affairs expert since the early 2000s, and I've covered lots and lots of murder trials. Death penalty cases. I went up to the Florida State Prison in 2012 for an execution up there. So some of this stuff just kind of comes second nature to me, but it's such a joy to be able to have a fresh set of eyes come in and look at this material and help, you know, kind of figure out the best way to tell these stories.
I appreciate that. Thank you.
It's a touch of the heart, too.
I come from a very digital-heavy background, not so much the cops and courts reporting that Melissa has. So we have very different backgrounds, and we were able to come together to produce this. And I'm really proud of it. I think that we've produced something that our newsroom hasn't really ever done before. So
yeah, this is definitely a first.
I hope that you guys do take the time to listen to it. There's 5 episodes. 4 of them are specific cases. The 5th one is a bonus episode where we dig into why we're here, more about the law changes in the brain science.
And that one was supposed to be our shortest episode. We really had our idea of thinking 15 minutes, we're going to be in and out. We just didn't want to spend too much time with each episode going into the history of the law changes of why these killers were allowed to come back in the first place, and the juvenile brain science and how research has advanced so much. Of scientists now have, you know, proof positive through PET scans and CAT scans and MRIs of what a juvenile brain looks like and how it changes over time, and that they really don't finish developing until their early 20s. But to me, that stuff is just fascinating. So our bonus episode ended up being our longest episode, but
it's a good episode. I think it's one of my favorites, so I would encourage you to go listen to that.
But listen to the other ones first, yeah, and then come back.
Yeah.
Yes.
Another question. Did you have to look at all the crime scene photos?
The short answer, yes. And did we enjoy it? No. I know that a couple of these cases that we covered, I had written about them in the past, so I knew that some of the images were there, and then having to go and see them for a second time was just as disturbing as the first time. But, you know, one of the reasons that it was really important, though, and I learned this a long time ago, you know, my first couple of murder trials that I covered, when it came time to put the autopsy photos up and the really horrible crime scene photos, I'm thinking, wait a minute, I'm not on the jury. I don't need to make this decision. Do I need to see these images? And I'd bolt out the door and then come back later. But then I realized I was making a mistake by doing that, because sometimes as an observer in trying to write these stories, the having to look at these horrible images and the impact it has on the jury, or the impact that it has on the family members, or even the defendant, are they staring at him? Does it freak him out? That becomes the story, in a sense. So I made a decision a long time ago that I stay in court when these images come up on the big screen. And, you know, like the Tyler Hadley case, you know, I've now seen those autopsy photographs twice, and I'll never get those images out of my head. And I really, really, really hope that I never have to see them again.
Melissa sat through every day, all day that she could, of all of these hearings. I was in and out recording audio, doing some other stuff for the project, and so I saw my fair share of them as well. There were family members that stepped out, and they chose not to look at these photos, which obviously I think we completely understand, but we felt that one of us needed to be in there because it is just part of the story.
And in fact, in the James Morgan case, and we didn't really know this going in, the victim in this case, Gertrude Turbevich, she was 61 years old in 1977 when this murder occurred. So her grandchildren were very young. They were like middle school. So their parents didn't let them go to any of the trials. They weren't allowed to participate in any of the court proceedings. So now these women in their 50s were seeing some of these images for the very first time. And I wasn't really aware of that until we started to see how they reacted. And then some of the other family had said, oh yeah, they've, you know, even though there were 4 trials, 4 death penalties for James, they had never, this was the first time seeing these images. And, you know, it was pretty overwhelming.
Another question, what was it like talking to the victims' families? And this person pointed out that it's not our fault that they're going through this, but we are asking them to talk to us about it.
Why don't you start?
Interesting question. Yeah, it's a hard thing to ask somebody to talk to you about such a really hard thing in their life. Melissa had to be the one to reach out and contact the families. And at first, some of them said no. And then after a while, they would have a change of heart and they did come back and talk to us. I think one of my first experiences of sitting down with a family was when we went up to Brevard County and sat down with, this is from our first episode,
With
Robert Rawlings' family. Yeah. His daughters, this case happened almost 50 years ago. So these
1968.
His daughters are in their 60s and
70s.
Even older now. They turned us down at first.
Yes, they did.
And then they did decide to bring us back into their home, and we sat down. I think we planned on being there maybe half an hour, 45 minutes. We were there for 3 hours, and it was just an incredible experience of being immersed in their story and their grief, and to see them open up to us and to just see the family dynamic that they have, because you could see how all of the sisters played a different role in that family, where one of them was the really strong one and one of them, you know, had just
more frail
to this day. And so just to see all of that in person, experience it, meet them, they were so kind to let us in and tell us their stories. And it was heartbreaking to watch them talk about it, because they broke down, and it was hard for us, I think,
to not break down. Just keep writing, don't cry, right? Keep writing, don't cry, you know?
So she's asking questions and writing things down. I'm there just sitting there recording things, making sure that the recording is still going. I'm not doing anything but sitting there. So I'm like, okay, you know, keep it together and be professional right now. In short, it was hard and it sucked, and we don't want to do that to people, but that's the story.
And part of the story, too, and we talked about this a little bit earlier, you know, when we first contacted Robert Rawlings' family, they did turn us down. And it was, I think it was in October. And we were like, well, okay, we can't force anybody to talk to us. I mean, it's, you know, that's one thing about being a journalist. You can't force anybody to talk to you. It's totally their choice. And a couple of weeks went by, and I got a phone call back from one of the daughter's husbands, Danny Reeves. And he said, okay, we changed our mind. He says, we had a family meeting, and we decided that maybe if we talk to you and Daisha and we tell you what we've been going through, we know that there are other families, because, you know, there were about 600 juvenile killers in the state of Florida that have this opportunity to come back, and about 2,500 across the country. And they said, we want to talk to you. Hopefully we could have a message to other families who are going through the same thing. You know, so they kind of have their own reasons of why they changed their mind and decided to talk to us. And it was a result of a family meeting, you know, and there were some people that turned us down, and I can totally respect that. Mm-hmm. You know, it was a really hard thing walking into an interview where you know you're going to be taking these people to a very painful place and ask them to relive what might be the most gut-wrenching emotional time of their life. And part of me felt really guilty about that. But on the other hand, I felt a responsibility that if they did want to share their stories with us in hopes of connecting with someone else going through the same thing, because there is that miracle of identification, you know, and we saw this in our Facebook Live that we did a couple of years ago on this same kind of thing, where victims, family members who had never connected before, because we did a Facebook Live thing, they were able to say, well, my family went through this, and it was in the Treasure Coast. Well, really, my family, you know, we're going through the same thing. And they were able to connect, and they could talk to each other in a way that we could never speak to them. So in that respect, I feel like it was a really good thing that we were able to find some of these families to speak to us. But we also tried to kind of get in and get out, you know, talk to them, get the information that they were willing to share, and not belabor the point, you know, or try to, you know, just take them to such an uncomfortable place.
And you're a veteran journalist, so you were good at that in the first place, but on some occasions in, like, the Bob Rawlings families, like we were talking, his daughters I was talking about, it's kind of like they wanted us to stay for a little while, because once they started to let it all out,
they had a story to tell.
They wanted to let it out, and so we let them. So we weren't like, oh, we got to go. Like, no, we're going to sit with you for 3 hours if you're going to let us stay in your house for 3 hours. And we did. Yeah. And so we stayed there pretty late. We had lots of hugs goodbye once we were done. So it was quite the experience.
You remember when with Lanadial Ash, the victim in that case was Tariq Hussein. He was 25 years old when he was killed December 5th, 1995. And he had a brother who was just a few years older than him, Ozzy Hussein. And they were very close. Tariq came from Pakistan as a young boy. His father had been recruited by the University of Florida to come here. His father was a leading entomologist in Pakistan, and he was recruited to come here to study mosquitoes, of all things. So we contacted Ozzy. We knew he was going to come to court for the resentencing. And he said, come to my office and talk to me. I'll talk to you. And he gave us the address of where his office is in Lakewood Park in Fort Pierce area in St. Lucie County. And it was in the exact same building where they had the five-star food store where this murder occurred. And I was like, wait a minute. You mean to tell me since 1995, every single day you come to your tax office and your real estate business, you come back to the exact same building, the same spot where your brother was killed? And he said, yeah, every day since then. I was like, oh my gosh. You know, but you know, this is where it's their building. It's where, you know, so after speaking to him for about an hour in his office, I'll never forget, I was curious, but I wasn't sure if he would do it. I asked Ozzy if he would be willing to take my photographer and I down, it was a couple of doors down, where the five-star food store used to be. It's a post office, little store, walk-up, you know, post office. And we had been speaking, like I said, for a while. And he said, sure, okay, I'll take you down there. And I'll never forget this as long as I live. So we exited his little tax office. We walked about three doors down. We came into the post office, and he told the lady behind the counter, you know, who we were, and we asked her permission to be there. And so he walked up. I mean, immediately he said, you know, the cigarette display was here, and the coolers were over here. And he just described to a T what the inside of the five-star food store used to look like. And then he walked over to a spot, and he stood there, and he says, It was right here. This was the place. And that's all he said. And I looked at him. I looked at my photographer. I looked back at Ozzy. And I knew exactly what he meant, that this is where Tariq was. And, I mean, just the silence came over us. None of us said anything. We just stood there for about 15 seconds. And at the end of that silence, I says, okay, I think it's time to go. And that was it. That was just really something, yeah. You know. But Ozzy wanted to talk to us. You know, he wanted to tell his story. I think that he felt like by speaking to us and telling us what his family had gone through and still goes through to this day, it helps them remember Tariq and makes him a person again and not just a memory.
Yeah. And what I noticed in when we talk to any of the victims' families, for them, this is like it happened yesterday. We talked to Angel Halstead's mom, and she remembered what she was making for dinner the night that her daughter disappeared.
Every single thing.
So that was hard to listen to, hard to ask them to tell us those stories. But I think without their voices, this podcast wouldn't have been what it is.
Right. And that's another question that, you know, I'm going to jump down to that. And somebody asked us, what was the point of this podcast? And that's a really interesting question in one respect, because to me, being this longtime legal affairs journalist, my first thought is, well, what do you mean, what's the point of this podcast? Didn't you listen to the episodes? It's like, we're here to tell you, you know, about the impact of these people's lives and what they're going through, you know, but it's so much bigger than that, though. It's to explain why these cases are coming back, but it's also to... It's just to make this real, you know, that these are stories happening in your own communities, and it's real people's lives that are being changed by decisions that are made by the U.S. Supreme Court, by the Florida Supreme Court, by the way that prosecutors have to handle a case and a way that a public defender prepares for it. And telling the stories of these people in their own words and not just hearing us retell it. There's, to me, it's just no comparison.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. Hi, Leah. I saw Nicole joined us as well. Sorry about the connectivity issues. I guess our studio...
Must be our closet.
I know. Our studio must not get the best reception.
Our servers are right behind us as well.
Even though,
I'm going to blame it on that.
Even though the dry run worked perfectly fine earlier, go figure, we're having problems now. Anyways, I will repost this whole video as soon as we're done, and you can watch it again if you're having any issues. Please drop us any questions that you have. If we don't answer them now, I will answer them in the next few days. Melissa can jump in and answer some questions,
too. Yeah, I'd be happy to.
So we've got a few more questions to go through. One of them is, how did each of us become interested in creating a podcast like this one?
Well, first of all, I've been studying these issues of these juvenile offenders who are serving life in prison because they committed a murder. Really, it dates back to the Tyler Hadley case. Tyler Hadley is a Port St. Lucie, he's a man now, 25 years old. He was 17 years old when he killed his parents with a claw hammer in 2011. And the following year, during his prosecution, there was a major U.S. Supreme Court decision came down called Miller v. Alabama. And what it did is it banned automatic mandatory life prison terms for minors. It didn't say you can't give a minor life in prison, but you had to have a special sentencing. You have the judge has to take all these things into consideration. What was their youth like? Was there peer pressure? Were they the shooter? Was there PTSD, childhood trauma? All these kinds of things to see if life was really appropriate. Are they the worst of the worst? So as Tyler was being prosecuted, we knew that all of these changes in the law were coming down, and it was most likely going to affect his sentencing, which it did. He ended up getting a do-over himself. So I kind of became fascinated with these stories. And putting words on a page and writing them from court is one thing, but to have a medium like a podcast to then take the challenge on, okay, can we find archive audio? Did they record the original trial? What's out there that we can bring these stories that were decades old to life? So it became a really big challenge for us. Considering we had no recording equipment, we had no studio, but you know, all along the way, our bosses said yes. We got the support that we needed, and we just kept finding a new way to get over whatever challenge it was in trying to tell these stories. You know, to me, I just thought it was a fascinating way to tell stories that I was very familiar with, but have written many times, you know, words on a page. Now we had a chance to have other voices come in and help us tell these stories. I mean, to me, that's kind of what jazzed me about the whole thing.
I think I definitely agree. I was part of your original investigation. I did a lot of the digital parts of, you know, we put bios together of the 23 treasure and space
cases. She did a lot of heavy lifting. Yeah, no two ways about it.
So I was involved in the investigation in the first place. And then when talks came around about, you know, maybe we could turn this into a podcast, it was just an idea for a long time. I had zero podcast experience. But one of my jobs here at TC Palm in the newsroom is to bring innovation into our newsroom. So I said, you know, hey, maybe we can actually do this. I'm willing to try. I love to tinker with things and learn things and teach myself how to do things. So that was a huge opportunity for me to learn a new way to tell stories. And so that part really excited me. Plus, I already had the interest because I had been involved in Melissa's investigation in the first place. So I was just like, you know what? Let's try this.
Right.
At first, I had no intention of being on the podcast. I just wanted to be behind the scenes as the producer. Melissa very nicely dragged me into
I'd done radio news for a couple of years before I became a print reporter back in 1999. So I had spoken into a microphone before. Here on the Treasure Coast, I used to actually go by Melissa McKay. Which when I came here and started writing as Melissa Holzman, they're like, did you get married? It was like, no, people use fake names in radio all the time. So I love the idea of being able to go back and do something more along the lines of radio, you know, because I mean, most people, they have to pay me to shut up, you know, because one thing I can do is talk.
And she
knows it. Everybody knows that. Yeah, they're laughing out there, I know. But again, I didn't want you guys to just get totally burnt out listening to me go on and on and on telling these stories. I was like, Daisha, we're going to completely switch things up. Let's do this together. Yeah. Let's just talk about these stories. You know, let's just kind of rip the script up a little bit and just talk about what we've experienced. And that's really what we tried to do here.
And then I think once I figured out that I don't suck at speaking, that was...
I knew you would be great.
That was step one. Step two, I think I really figured out that between your ability to track down the archive audio and to tell the legal side of the story, being willing to contact the families and ask them to talk to us. She's really good at that stuff. I'm not. But I'm good at the digital side of things. So I thought, you know what, maybe we can actually do this. The two of us can become a solid team.
We had worked on things together, you know, basically the way it works where I was the one that put the words on the page and she was the one that just kind of brought all that digital magic together and just made it mwah, sing. So we had worked a little bit together, but this was our first major project together. And the first time that we ever tried speaking, we didn't even have a studio yet. And we went up to WQCS in Fort Pierce. God bless Jill Roberts and the rest
of her
up there. Thank you. Yes. It's NPR and the Treasure Coast. I said, hi, hey, we need to use your studio. We need a couple of microphones. I've got this. I want to hear how we sound together. You remember? So we had been up in Indian River County. We were getting some audio off of VHS tapes from a 1990 trial. And sure enough, we talked for a half hour or so. And the minute I heard us talking together, I knew that this was going to work. Yeah. So anyway, we don't need to belabor that point too much.
Yeah, sorry, quite the tangent there. But yeah, and just to remind y'all, this has been more than a year in the making, and it's been more than a year of Melissa working together pretty much every day.
Yeah, we're sick of each other, no.
Lots of text messages and emails over weekends and talking at night.
And tears. Oh yeah, my gosh.
Yeah.
I mean, honestly, one of the hardest things about putting these episodes together is listening to the audio again of the family members, either in court or when they were talking to us. I would text Daisha and I was like, oh my God, I'm crying. I'm listening to Diane again and I'm crying. And then a couple of days later, she's like, I'm listening to, you know, who it might be, you know, and somebody different and I'm crying. And I got to think, was like, well, shoot, if this is making us cry, then I think maybe we're getting our point across.
Yeah, we wanted to make a pretty big impact. And on that note, we have had a few people reach out to us to say, these episodes are fantastic and the stories you're telling are amazing, but I had to stop halfway through and take a break. And they said that they did finish, but they had to take that break in there because these episodes are, they're intense and they're sad and they're very real. I think that's what I was hoping to do. I was hoping to bring all of you into the courtroom or into the family room and make it really real for you, the listener, as it is for the people going through it.
Yeah, and you know, there's no two ways about it. I mean, I get it. I have friends and family members, they won't listen to these episodes. They won't do it. When you talk about murder, it's kind of a niche, and that true crime, it's not for everybody. And I really understand that. But at the same time, you know, it was never our goal to try and exploit any of the voices or the emotions that were being portrayed or sensationalize it. In fact, I think one of the biggest compliments that I'll ever take away is Marty Hancock, the daughter of Gertrude Turbevich from our 1977 murder here in Stewart. It's in episode 4. She posted on my Facebook page after she listened to the episode that she felt like Daisha and I had done a good job of sticking to the facts and that we didn't sensationalize the story. Because, you know, James is kind of a unique case in all the ones that, in fact, we can go in and talk about one of our next questions is, why did James Morgan, his death penalty get overturned? Well, he had 4 death penalties and 4 trials, and every one of them was overturned. His murder, he occurred in 1977. He was 16 years old. And the trial took about less than a year. Back in those days, I mean, you go from the time that the crime was committed until the time the trial happened and you were off to prison in less than a year. Now it takes, you know, 2, 3, 4 years to get ready for a trial like this. But every time the Florida Supreme Court found some sort of flaw in the way that they had reached the death penalty in his case, and they were bothered by how young he was. They were bothered by the fact that there was claims that he had been drinking that day, he'd been huffing gasoline, that maybe he wasn't right in the head. There were doctors that said that he was mentally disturbed. So every time they overturned his death penalty, and on the 4th time, after he'd lived on death row for about 17 years and been married and divorced by then, by the way, in 1994, they commuted his sentence to life. And this family of his murder victim thought this time that was it. It was over with. They wouldn't have to come back anymore. But back in those days, it was life with the possibility of parole after 25 years. It was built into the sentence. So every so often, Morgan would come back up for parole and they would have to go up to Tallahassee. So literally for 41 and a half years, this family has been going through this. And then they got the word that because of changes in the law that they had no control over, James got to come back to a new judge, not the parole board this time, but a new judge to see if he could either get less than life or possibly even go free. And that just rocked their world. No two ways
about
it.
Yeah, again, that was episode 4, James Morgan in the 1977 Stewart murder. I think of all the feedback I've gotten, people have said that that one is one of the most intense.
Yeah.
My guess is because the audio that we have in that one is very intense. That is, I will say it now, that's the one day that I cried in court, was when we were recorded at
Beth.
For
yeah, Beth his, Jones.
Her granddaughter for that
pretty
episode.
Heavy duty.
So I think we have one or two more questions here. Oh, I did want to say really quick, we were talking about some of the comments that we've gotten. This was a really big compliment, I thought, that we got. And it was a friend of mine said to me that in listening to all of these episodes, you know, people can binge shows like CSI and these other crime scene type shows.
The fake shows.
But for so many people to reach out and tell us how good this is, but that they had to take breaks, it's because it brought the humanity back into it, and it brought the people back into it. Instead of just watching something kind of fake on TV, this was very real. And so, you know, as hard as it is to tell these kind of stories, they are so important to tell. So I am glad to hear that people are taking away what we had hoped.
Yeah, and I'll be the first to admit that I do listen to podcasts quite a bit. I don't listen to a whole lot of true crime podcasts because that's kind of what I do for a living. So by the time my day is over, I don't really, you know, go back into that dark place. You know, I want to kind of think about, you know, butterflies.
We have a question coming in from Laura Lemon. Okay. Which of the stories you told was the hardest for each of you and why? Just join. Sorry if you already answered this. Well, I think I kind of just said mine. James Morgan was pretty tough. That is the one episode when recording the audio. I did cry in court. I couldn't even believe the amount of emotion that was taking place up on the witness stand. And that was one of the only hearings that I did sit through every single day. I mentioned earlier that I kind of bounced in and out of court because I was working on other episodes and this and that. But that, I think you were out of town for a couple days.
Yeah, I snuck out to Iceland for a few days, yes.
So I had to be there every single day. So that was tough for me. And then having to relive the entire episode in putting it together just made me, you know, brought me right back into that space.
Yeah, you know, I think that there's, for me, the toughest it took me a couple of days to kind of like, you know, and shake it off, was sitting with Robert Rawlings' family.
Yeah.
Number one, that was our first in-depth interview that we had done, and we didn't even know how many episodes we were going to have at that point, or we hadn't written anything. We were still just kind of collecting information.
I don't even know if we were going to have a podcast at that point.
Right.
We were just trying to figure out.
And in thinking about it later, I mean, I knew that tears were streaming down my face while I was in their living room and speaking to all of them, because it was kind of a small little room, and we were surrounded by this loving family, and there was Dasha and I. So, you know, there was no escaping from the depth of emotion that they were willing to share with us. But at the same time, when you're in court and you're doing your job and you've got everything happening so much at once, it's a lot easier to kind of like sort of take on that first responder sort of thing where you just like, okay, do your job. You know, you have to just kind of detach a little bit because I have a responsibility to take down the words and you're recording and you're watching. And, you know, so it's a little bit easier to kind of detach from that. And honestly, probably the hardest case for me where I was in court, and this will be in the next season of Uncertain Terms, provided that you all support us and we get to do that, was Tyler Hadley. And when he came back for the resentencing in this past October, for the second time he was being sentenced, I've gotten to know his uncle and his two aunts on his dad's side. over the years pretty well. And I have a tremendous amount of respect for them. And because I have talked to them so frequently and seen them so many times over the years, to watch them come in one more time and have to, I mean, because Michael Hadley would say it every time. He says, I feel like we've just been through another funeral. You know, because the original prosecution and then his sentencing and then he won an appeal and then to come back for another sentencing, he says, I really feel like we've just gone to a third funeral. And that was a tough one to to not cry while I was doing that. Yeah. So, yeah. Thanks, Laura, for that question there. It made us feel miserable all over again. No.
Do you want to ask that last question? You're going to tease me a little.
Oh, yeah. Well, it's kind of related to this, isn't it?
It is related to this.
Yeah,
and
it's not my question. It came in from somebody. You know, did this project screw with your head?
Yeah, I've been asked this question at least three times. And yeah, it did. This was tough. Melissa has 30 years of experience in cops, courts, and legal affairs. I don't. This was brand new to me. And, you know, it's a little bit different getting out of a newsroom and into a courtroom. And just being so immersed in all this, in the audio of listening and editing audio every single day for more than a year, yeah, it messed with my head. And it was, I cried in one of our interviews with NPR. Sorry, Jill. She asked me a question in this room, and I just broke down. And I was like,
where did that come from? Wow. Oh, my gosh.
And it was just a big release.
So as soon as you started crying, I was like, oh.
It was a big release because this has been a more than a year-long project, and it's been a long time coming, but...
Yeah, and what really helped too is because you were really the only other person in my life that really understood what I was going through in creating this series. We texted a lot at night and on the weekends, and, you know, and she never said, hey, I'm busy, don't do this, you know, and I hope that you never felt like that.
No, because
that sometimes, maybe that was all I needed, was just somebody to like, hey, I know what you're feeling, you know, and then I could kind of like put it back in its little box and, you know, kind of go on with what I was doing, you know.
But I do want to say that as difficult as this was for me or for us to produce, this is nothing compared to what these families had to go through.
Oh, that's the truth.
I just really want to put that out there that what I had to go through is nothing.
I mean, we're just observers.
So, yeah, we're just observers in this. We're listeners. We're storytellers, but we didn't have to live through this, and these families that spoke to us did.
And I will be forever grateful for the ones who did agree to share their stories with us, because again, none of them had to. They all chose for their own personal reasons why they wanted to tell their story. And I don't know how, you know, I could do this for another 20 years and I'll never be able to walk in a victim's family member's shoes, you know, some of these cases, and we talked about this, you know, like how do you feel? You know, I sleep just fine at night knowing that some of these guys are never going to get out. You know, I just feel like, you know, that maybe they are better with, they're not living with the rest of us. And yet some of these other cases, you know, after 20, 30 years behind bars, they are different people. They absolutely have changed. There is something to this rehabilitation that happens. There is a transformation that happens to some people behind bars, you know, and others, it never will. They are either, you know, their brains are broken or there's something going on there that they're never going to be safe. It's a tough call for every one of these, you know, and I think that we have a little bit of a taste of what it's like for prosecutors, you know, to go through this. One last question. Well, I don't know if this is our last, but do you have any stats on how many received reduced terms versus life again? I don't have any exact numbers here in the state of Florida, but what I can share with you is there are some public defenders that are trying to kind of keep track of how many of these cases are coming through, how many are been released, and how many are going back for life, because a lot of this stuff is still being litigated in court. And I saw a motion from a defense lawyer that said that of the cases that have come back for resentencings in about the last 3 years, about 60 of them have either gotten a reduced term or have been freed. It's still pretty unusual for them to go free. I mean, this is highly unusual. We do have an episode, our first episode, I wasn't going to say that.
Spoiler alert!
Spoiler alert, yeah. Well, hopefully you've already listened to all of them. But what I got from the Department of Corrections, though, there are probably around 150 of these juvenile homicide offenders who were eligible for resentencing who have received their resentencing. And this is going to continue for at least another 2 years. There are, I would guess, maybe another 100 across the state of Florida, perhaps, that are still pending. You know, and it takes months and months to put these cases together to get ready to go for a hearing.
Yeah. Well, we've been talking for a long time, so I think we're going to wrap it up. Thank you, all of you who tried to tune in. I'm so sorry for our connectivity issues. I will take responsibility for that. I will repost the entire video. You can watch it from the start, and there shouldn't be any interruptions if I re-upload it. So feel free to drop in any questions in the newly uploaded video or this one. I'll be watching for questions in the next few days. If you like what we're doing and this kind of storytelling, please support us. tcpalm.com/subscribe.
Absolutely, what she said.
I mean, we can't do this for free. I wish we could, but we got to make a living too here. So please subscribe to TC Palm. We work so hard in this newsroom to bring you the best local news. And if you could also do us a favor after you listen to the episodes, if you could leave a review, also give us a rating in there, 5 stars if you feel
like you can do that. Apple Podcasts, SoundCloud, Spotify. There's a lot of different ways that you can dive in and listen and then leave us a rating, review. We love to get your feedback. We've got an email address, uncertainterms@tcpalm.com. We're on Twitter. Come have a chat with us. You know, let us know how you feel about these stories. If you'd like to see more of them, the more that we know from the rest of you that you want to hear more about these stories, the more we can convince the bosses to set us loose on
season 2. Yes, because we really want to get going on that season 2. So
yes.
We're on Twitter, like Melissa said, @uncertainterms. I'm on there pretty much all day, every day, even on the weekends. So
yes,
come
is.
Talk to me. And we can't thank you all enough for the support that we have gotten. It's been a long year, but I'm really proud of what we did.
I am too. Deja Johnson, thank you for your help.
Thank you, Melissa Holzman. It's been fun. All right. Thanks for tuning in, guys.
Bye.
Just going to run this dog to see if we can find any type of human remains that are left.
Listen to Where Secrets Go to Die, The Disappearance of Derek Hennigan. From the Detroit Free Press, a new podcast set in the woods of Michigan's Upper Peninsula. Available on Apple, Spotify, Freep.com, or wherever you get your podcasts.